It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about why Apple may be trying to replace your cable provider.
First, though, we'll talk to WPR reporter Gilman Halstead about new ways that Wisconsin is dealing with those who commit crimes.
State officials met last Friday to discuss a possibly expanding a system that offers alternatives to jail time.
Also, local officials are meeting today to consider a new pre-trial screening process that could reform how people are let out on bail.
Gilman, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, let's start off with this conference you were at on Friday, the Treatment Alternatives and Diversion Conference. That was here in Madison. What was that all about?
Well, it was an opportunity for people from around the state, mainly judges, prosecutors, attorneys, and specialty court coordinators, I guess we can call them, drug courts and OWI courts that are multiplying across the state right now, to talk about the successes that they've had and get some encouragement, actually, from state officials like State Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen and Department of Corrections Secretary Ed Wall.
And now, what kind of alternatives are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about treatment to a large extent, basically mandating treatment instead of locking people up in jail or in prison, where treatment oftentimes is less available, actually, where there are waiting lists. But to mandate people to go into treatment and give, in many cases, give them the opportunity to have a conviction erased if they complete a treatment program and remain drug-free for a certain period of time. So it's both for drugs and for now increasingly for there are OWI courts that are multiplying around the state as well. And they seem to be working. They seem to be saving counties money. And the statistics that were being reported on were pretty impressive. It's only been going on in 8 to 10 counties, and Governor Walker put another $1 million in the budget this year to expand that to maybe another 10 or a dozen counties.
And who's doing this so far around the state?
Well, it's 8 different counties, and it's there are some in the five. It's really all over the state. It's scattered, but the big cities have been Milwaukee has been doing it, Madison has been doing it, Eau Claire, La Crosse, and some scattered counties up in the north and in the Fox Valley.
I remember when you and the rest of the news team did that series on heroin.
Right.
A theme that kept coming back up is going to prison is not effective heroin treatment. Are we seeing good results from what you heard from the attendees at this conference on getting people off of their addiction to heroin, other drugs, alcohol?
Yeah, and it's it has been effective with a certain population of people who are amenable to treatment. But I think the main thing that's really driving it, Rob, is money. I mean, the amount of money that's being spent to lock people up instead of treatment, that's what we heard a lot about at this conference, was that we've saved $12 million just in these counties over the last 8 years. Some of those statistics, some would argue a little bit with, but we have definitely saved a lot of money. That means that instead of spending in prison $30,000 a year to incarcerate these people, we've been letting them remain in the community and providing treatment for them, which is much less expensive than paying their room and board all day long.
Is everybody in the law enforcement community among these prosecutors and judges buying into this, or is there some pushback?
Well, I have to tell you, I think the majority of law enforcement folks really are. I mean, we had the top law enforcement, chief cop there at the conference, the attorney general, definitely endorsing this. There are a few law enforcement folks around the state, and I guess I would single out, I don't think it's a surprise to many people, that the sheriff of Milwaukee is not a big fan of these approaches and takes a much more traditional tough-on-crime approach and is suspicious of what he calls social engineering rather than traditional criminal justice.
Hmm. I know there's been a spate of criminal justice-related news lately. That's part of why we wanted to bring you in today. Another thing that you are reporting on that we thought was interesting is a new approach to the people before they go into a trial. They're in jail. Do they get out on bail? Changes might be in the works there?
Well, we know they're innocent till proven guilty, but once you're charged, often depending on the crime you're charged with, you're going to be asked to post bail unless you look like someone who will come back to trial without doing that, and you get released on personal recognizance. And so they're putting these new systems in place that are called risk assessment screenings, and these have been tested across the country, validated, and judges are now using them and are actually detaining fewer people on lower level, usually nonviolent crimes, and not requiring them to pay bail, and setting up a set of conditions where they have to call in or sometimes wear bracelets to make sure that they come back to trial to determine whether or not they're guilty or not, and then actually get sentenced.
So under the current system, if, knock wood, I'm arrested, I go through the initial processing, they say, okay, Rob, we're going to let you out, but you need to pay a significant amount in. We're going to hold that as a surety to make sure you haul your butt back in here.
Right, and there's less of that going on now. And actually, the reform movement going on across the country is trying to eventually get rid of money completely from that bail system and make the decision on whether we're going to hold you in jail or let you out based solely on your risk and not on how much money you can put up.
And how do they – that's got to be an interesting a bit of calculus there. How do you evaluate whether Gil's going to run and Rob's going to stay or vice versa?
Well, traditionally, it's the same way that they would determine a bail amount. I mean, they look at your criminal record. They look at your ties to the community, family, whether or not you have a job. Those are the three main things they're going to look at. But they also may look at whether or not you are a primary provider for the family. Are you the sole do you have custody of a child that you're responsible for?
So something tying you there to the community.
Right, yeah. And something that would actually might be beneficial to the community if they didn't hold you in jail and let you go home and take care of your kid.
Mm-hmm. And are people languishing in jail for long periods of time now because they can't post bail or because the bail amount is too high or non-existent?
No, I don't think there's a lot of long languishing going on. That's been true in other parts of the country. And again, I guess what I would come back to here that the advocates of these reform are focusing on the money involved. That instead of filling that jail cell, which costs a certain amount of money per day to hold someone in, the county is actually saving money by using this different approach to monitoring and assuring that these people who've been arrested and charged with a crime are actually going to show up in court and not commit another crime in between.
Now, who's getting together to talk about this today and what would be their steps moving ahead?
No. Actually, there's nobody.
Oh, it's not today.
No,
I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that was part of the Friday thing
as Friday.
Well. There were two thrusts to that conference on Friday. One were this treatment and diversion for people who've been evicted, and also this pretrial diversion. So both of those were themes of this,
gotcha.
And they both got encouragement for the most part from the folks in charge of both the prison and the justice system in the state.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about. You've been following stories over the years of police-related shootings, deaths in police custody. I know these are things you're tracking. We're seeing maybe some effort in the state legislature to change the way those cases are reviewed. What is going on there?
Right. Well, there is a system already in place that large police departments like Madison and Milwaukee, and I think some of the Green Bay and Eau Claire, when there is a police-involved shooting, they investigate themselves, and they have perhaps the sheriff's department there or the DA's office sort of shadow it. But in other parts, in the smaller police jurisdictions, they'll ask the DOJ to come and do a completely independent one. And there's a move now towards passing a law that would require all police departments to have a completely independent outside investigation of a police officer, of a shooting that's taken place where someone's been killed. Because there's a sense that we had these shootings here in Madison, and there have been ones in Milwaukee as well recently, where the public just doesn't trust that a fellow police officer involved in investigating his buddy is going to do a really fair review. And this is to sort of change that perception.
And you've interviewed people in the Madison community on that shooting you mentioned. Is this the sort of thing they've been hoping for from the state legislature?
Yes, I think very much so. And Representative Gary Bies, who's actually a former deputy sheriff from Door County, Republican, has agreed to, has begun drafting this bill, and it's beginning to get a lot of support statewide. It looks like, you know, we'll have to wait till it gets a hearing to really get a sense. I think there's some pushback from police unions concerned about losing control over those investigations and increasing distrust of police. But it looks like it may really go somewhere this year.
Well, Gil, three stories that will follow as they develop. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
That was WPR reporter Gilman Halstead.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll hear the latest on Apple's newest plan to potentially disrupt the tech world with Apple TV. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. Apple TV was released back in 2007. They were trying to create a more seamless television watching experience, and it was kind of modeled on the other Apple products out there.
Well, they sold about 13 million Apple TV boxes. It hasn't been quite the hit that Apple's other products have been yet.
There's some news, though. Apple is getting together, trying to get together with TV content providers. Maybe they're looking to bypass cable altogether, kind of like Netflix?
And here to talk about this with us is Gina Chan. She's a former corporate reporter for Quartz. Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So Apple's been in conversation with television content providers at places like ESPN, HBO. What are they up to?
Yeah, well, the parties are trying to figure out if they could come to an agreement where these content providers like HBO and ESPN would be a part of Apple TV, which would actually be a TV set that would resemble, you know, basically a giant iPad and try to bypass the cable companies.
And this would be kind of the last blow for the idea of having a TV schedule, wouldn't it? I mean, it would be I'd have a TV with apps on it that I'd view, or is that how it would work?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And, you know, consumers are already starting to move down that path with House of Cards from Netflix and obviously DVR and TiVo, and, you know, more and more TV watchers are watching their programs on their own time, and this would be sort of the ultimate expression of that.
Now, ultimately, this is supposed to be a TV set that Apple is selling, essentially, right? It's not just going to be a box.
Yeah, no, exactly. They want to provide both the hardware and software, much like they do with the iPhone and iTunes, where basically Apple wants to own the whole experience. You know, if they just have something you can plug into your TV, then the TV may not work the way that Apple wants it to. So they really want to control the whole thing.
Do you think that this is what people want their TV experience to be like? I mean, Apple has gotten out ahead of markets before. Do you think they're onto something here?
Well, you know, this is a vision that Steve Jobs had before he passed away. He, you know, I think famously said in his autobiography that he felt like he sort of cracked the code for TV. And, you know, certainly consumers are looking for sort of that all-in-one experience, and especially younger people these days. You know, a lot of them don't even have TVs. They're just watching things off of their tablet or their laptop through streaming services. So TV is constantly changing, and it seems like, you know, the players who are important are changing as well.
Now, do you think that this could be, should it get off the ground, a game changer for the way that we watch television? Is it even television anymore?
Yeah, no, it would definitely be a huge change, especially for the cable companies. And I mean, some of the executives even start to talk about a sort of a distant future where they might not even be part of TV. They would more be just the internet service provider. And that's basically what an Apple TV set would do, where cable companies would just be another app on the Apple TV next to HBO, Netflix, Hulu, and others. Obviously, the demise of cable would be a long time coming. I don't think even if Apple TV succeeds that would happen right away. But, you know, they've definitely put, you know, pressure on the music industry because of iTunes, and, you know, they will change the TV industry as well.
So Apple is out talking to some content providers. Can you get this is what you were reporting on. Can you give us some examples of the kind of people they're going to, hoping to get them on board with this?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because Apple has basically concluded that they don't need everybody. They don't need, you know, the hundreds of channels that you have available right now in your cable companies. Through your cable system, they feel that they only need to get enough of compelling programming that people, especially diehard TV watchers, would want to buy an Apple TV set. So that's why you have your obvious suspects of HBO and ESPN and others. The question is whether they can come to an agreement, because these content providers also have contracts with cable companies as well, who are obviously resisting Apple's efforts. So that's still a question of whether they can get enough content providers on board. But, you know, Apple is a very convincing negotiator. They've obviously had success in other areas. So we'll see how this one plays out.
Gina, who would be the big get for Apple? If they get this company on board, they're good to go. Because right now they don't seem to have that linchpin player in place. Who are they really wanting to snag?
Well, I think some of the sports channels, obviously ESPN would be a huge get. There's also the cable networks that have programming that people are obsessed with, whether it's HBO and Game of Thrones or Showtime. I'm, you know, guessing that AMC could also be in there with Mad Men and other shows that they have. So it's really those programs that everyone talks about, everyone's sort of obsessed with and needs to watch as soon as it airs. Those are really the ones that Apple needs to get, because if you get enough of those kinds of programs, then that would probably be enough to get buyers, especially sort of younger viewers who are already used to watching TV on their own terms.
Let's flip it around, though. Say I'm ESPN. I'm doing pretty good. I'm getting lots of money in my deals with cable companies. People are watching me. What's in it for me to jump on this Apple thing?
Well, that's the question of, you know, compared to the deals that they have now with cable companies, when they do get a lot of money in fees for that, versus what an Apple experience can give you. There's a lot of other things that being part of an Apple TV set where, you know, maybe you could pause it and just have various clips of highlights from a certain game. You could get stats of different players. You know, there's various other things that will likely come with an Apple TV set. Apple has also made certain small acquisitions. They're talking to an Israeli company that does motion control, where there's a sense that there could be some sort of gesture control as part of their TV. So if that becomes sort of the next cool thing that everyone wants to buy, then, you know, content providers like ESPN will likely want to be a part of it.
This is something that Steve Jobs had said he wanted to do. You know, he's gone. Do you have a sense of how much of this vision is his and how closely they're adhering to that vision?
Well, I think Steve Jobs definitely wanted to do this, and again said he had sort of cracked the code, but I think it's taken Apple much longer than the company thought it would, because this is a much more complicated industry than the music industry or the publishing industry with ebooks. There's a lot more players involved, where there's already set agreements that are difficult to get out of. So it's been much more complicated for Apple this time around than it's faced in other sectors.
And then just briefly, how are the existing cable providers reacting to this? Are they worried?
Yeah, no, they're definitely worried. I mean, Apple's been trying to talk to them as well, but they've been resisting because they feel like they will basically become, quote, a dumb pipe for Apple and just a conduit for them, much like, you know, AT&T has sort of become with the iPhone, and they don't want to be sort of, you know, pushed aside if they agree to this. So they're definitely pushing against it, but, you know, at some point they might just see, you know, the future and have to decide how much they want to be a part of it or not.
Any sense on the time frame, Gina, just real quick, about what we might see, what's going to happen with this?
Sure. Well, I've heard that, you know, Apple wants to get something by the end of this year, early next year. But again, it sort of depends on these contract negotiations, you know, what the content providers can get out of with their existing cable company agreements versus, you know, what Apple can offer.
Gina, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Gina Chan, our former reporter for Quartz.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about how, although cities are becoming increasingly hip, they're also becoming increasingly childless as families move away.
And we'll hear from a guest who says we need to focus on putting the culture back in agriculture.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 4, we'll look into the latest news about chemical weapons in Syria and questions about what, if anything, the United States should do about it.
First, this week is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, when hundreds of thousands of people rallied in the nation's capital for civil rights and more.
Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech at that march has gotten a lot of the attention, but our next guest says there was a lot more to it than that, and he's looking to recapture the forgotten history of that event.
William Jones joins us in the studio. Professor Jones is a professor of history at UW-Madison. His new book is The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Civil Rights Movement. Will, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, when I think of the March on Washington, I tend to think of a civil rights march aimed at ending segregation. But you point out in your book, the official name of the event was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. How central was that labor issue, the economic justice issue, in the march?
Well, that connection was really central, and it goes back to the origins of the 1963 march, in a march that was called in 1941 by the labor leader, A. Philip Randolph, who was the central leader of the 1963 march. And he called that march in 1941 to protest employment discrimination in the defense industries and discrimination and segregation within the armed forces during the Second World War. He called off the march when the President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued an executive order banning employment discrimination. But that act really established a number of important things that would emerge in what we would later call the civil rights movement. One, it placed A. Philip Randolph really at the center of that movement, and it placed that connection between jobs and freedom really as central to the goals of the movement.
Well, I wanted to focus in on Randolph some. Again, Martin Luther King Jr. is the person who probably pops into my mind anyway. I won't speak for everyone else when it comes to the march, but A. Philip Randolph is a key character in your book and a key figure in the history. Where did the idea of marching on Washington in the first place come to him, this idea of this tactic of protest?
Well, it was actually proposed by an anonymous woman, I don't really know much about her, at a mass meeting that A. Philip Randolph and his union, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, had organized to address these problems of discrimination within the defense industries and the armed forces. But it really appealed to Randolph because of his background. He was a leader of the Socialist Party. He was a leader of the union movement. And he believed that the most important way to affect political change was through mass mobilization and direct action, organizing mass protests. And so the idea, this really, he took this up as an idea to really test the ability and demonstrate the effectiveness of that strategy.
And there's Randolph. How much other overlap was there between the civil rights movement and the labor movement?
Well, the 1963 march, the march was first proposed in 41 and then called off. There were a number of attempts to build marches on Washington again, and some actual small marches in the 1950s. But the idea for reviving a really major march in the early 1960s came from an organization called the Negro American Labor Council, which A. Philip Randolph was the president of. But it was really a network of several thousand black trade unionists in cities, mostly in the North, but across the country, who were really alarmed at rising rates of unemployment and the continuation of employment discrimination, you know, really 20 years after this march had been called off in 1941. So the real impetus, the initial impetus for the 1963 march, the famous one, actually came from union activists themselves.
And within the civil rights movement, was everyone comfortable with the idea that they should be linking the movement to end segregation with the workers' rights movement?
Yeah. I mean, this was something, as I said, it went back to the 1940s. A. Philip Randolph, at the time of the 1963 march, was overwhelmingly seen as he was known as the dean of black leadership. He was widely respected within the civil rights movement. There weren't really people who argued against making this connection between economic justice and racial equality. That was a pretty widely shared belief. Where there was disagreement was really over strategy. So there were civil rights leaders who thought that the idea of a march was not probably the most effective way to reach this.
What were the efforts that they were looking at that they were worried the march might distract from? What were the other tactics?
Right. Well, 2 months before the March on Washington in August of 1963, President Kennedy had introduced a civil rights bill. And he had introduced this in the wake of the really violent clashes in Birmingham that many of our listeners are probably aware of, these scenes of people being attacked by police dogs and by fire hoses. And in response to that, President Kennedy introduced what was actually a fairly weak civil rights bill. But the civil rights leaders really wanted to promote this bill. And in fact, one of the main objectives of the March on Washington was to pass the bill and then also to strengthen it and to add certain things to it. So many civil rights leaders said, well, and actually Kennedy himself took this position, that if we want to pass this law, bringing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in a mass protest to Washington is probably not the best thing to do. It has the potential of ending in violence and discrediting the movement. It also will make some legislators feel as if they're being pressured by a lot of people at the time used the term, you know, mob actions and mob pressure. And the idea was that, you know, you shouldn't use this type of pressure. So they favored formal lobbying, talking to elected officials, going to Congress, meeting with them, and also lawsuits, which was something that the NAACP had done very effectively in the 1950s, most famously in winning the Brown decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, which overturned legal segregation.
So how did Randolph's argument that what they needed was this big high-profile march on Washington, how did that prevail?
Well, for two reasons. One, Randolph and a number of other leaders, most importantly Martin Luther King, but also the student leaders, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they all believed very strongly in this position, and they actually made it clear that they were going to do a march whether they had the support of these others or not. But there were a number of other things. One, they placed a great deal of emphasis on ensuring that the march was a nonviolent march and training and really keeping in training the participants in nonviolence and the importance of not being provoked. So there were actually a number of efforts to provoke violent clashes at the march. One, the city was very heavily armed. The American Nazi Party actually encouraged its members to go to Washington and taunt people who were marching. And so there had to be a great deal of care to explain to people that we cannot retaliate, there cannot be any violence. The other thing was that there were a number of mass marches, the most important one in Detroit, just a few weeks before the March on Washington, that came off very well. They were very successful. As many as over 100,000 people marched in Detroit. And again, this was ways of demonstrating that this could be effective.
And were they using those other marches as, in a way, trial runs, seeing what worked, seeing how the nonviolence training would go?
Well, I do think that the one in Detroit was seen by many people as this was organized by allies of Martin Luther King in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and also members of the Negro American Labor Council in Detroit. And I think they very consciously did that as a demonstration that they could pull it off effectively on a smaller scale.
And you mentioned the American Nazi Party trying to overtly provoke violence. Apart from them, how widespread was the concern that this would be violent, that the cameras were there to catch some kind of escalation into violence?
That was really the main story. If you read any of the newspaper reports from the weeks leading up to the march, the main headline was this could lead to rioting. This could lead to, it was stories about the preparations that local authorities were making. They were staging troops across the river with helicopters ready to bring them in. They emptied all the prisoners. They transferred all the prisoners out of the D.C. jails in anticipation that they'd have to fill them up with marchers. So, and this was the story over and over and over again in the local newspapers, in the national newspapers. So there was a great deal of concern. And the media really, that was what they emphasized and focused on.
And after, was the coverage a lot of surprise that that didn't happen, or did they just kind of forget those predictions?
No, it was. I mean, the big story afterward was, wow, this was peaceful and beautiful and a tremendous demonstration of sort of dignity. And I think in some ways the fear of violence may have played into that narrative, that there was this, it was this sort of expression of relief that I think really got the attention of the media. And I think for particularly for the media, this was played a role in a really tremendous sort of shift in perception.
We'll continue our conversation with historian Will Jones of UW-Madison, and you can join in if you have questions about the March on Washington, and we'll talk more about the role of jobs and economic justice issues in that march.
You can call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. Coming up after 4, look at what's going on in Syria and what the options are for the United States.
Now we continue our discussion with Will Jones about his new book, The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. So, Will, we've talked a lot about the lead-up to the event. Let's talk about the day itself. And I think A. Philip Randolph started off the speaking that day, if I read your book correctly. What was he looking for in terms of economic justice and jobs in the United States in his speech?
Well, yeah, it's really fascinating to me that, you know, the speech that everybody knows, it was the last of 10 speeches. And it was the end of a very long day. It actually, the day began for most people early the morning before, boarding buses. Most of them came on buses overnight. They arrived early in the morning, and then they gathered at the Washington Monument for some short speeches and music, and then had an actual march. And when they got to the Lincoln Memorial, A. Philip Randolph was the first speaker. He was the director of the march, and he really introduced it by laying out the goals, which, as he said, were about racial equality. It was about, he called it a moral revolution for civil rights. But he said it went far beyond civil rights, and it went far beyond, using the language of the time, Negroes. He said that this was about creating a just society for everyone, and it required calling not just for strong civil rights laws, but for federal policies that ensured jobs, decent housing, decent education for anybody in the United States.
And what kind of policy things were they hoping for from Congress, from the president, in terms of economic justice and jobs?
Right. Well, there's a whole range. I mean, all of their demands were aimed at strengthening the civil rights policies of the president. So they called for very strict enforcement of civil rights, of racial equality. They, for example, they wanted to reduce congressional representation in states where people were deprived the right to vote. They wanted to withdraw federal funding from local governments if they discriminated against their citizens. Perhaps the most important demand for most of the marchers there was what it was called at the time, a Fair Employment Practices Act, which was a law prohibiting employment discrimination by private employers or government employers or unions. And this was really the central demand that went back to the 1941 march. And that sort of straddles, it's both a civil rights demand and an economic demand. The purely economic demands were they wanted to raise the minimum wage. They wanted to essentially double the minimum wage to $2 an hour. That in today's terms is roughly $15 an hour. And they said that that was what it would require to give all workers a decent standard of living. They also wanted a federal job creation and training program to, as they said, to place all unemployed workers, black or white, in meaningful and dignified jobs at decent wages.
So A. Philip Randolph started off that series of speeches. Who else do you want to bring back into the limelight that we've forgotten about, part of the forgotten history there, that spoke that day?
Right. Well, I mean, One thing that I think is remarkable is the degree to which the other speakers, even ones who were not as radical as A. Philip Randolph, really echoed the points that he made. So some of the other speakers were Walter Reuther, who was the head of the United Auto Workers Union, Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP. Both of them were slightly to the moderate side of this group of people, and they really echoed that importance. I think probably one of the most remarkable speeches was given by John Lewis, who's now a congressman from Georgia, who was the representative of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. There was actually a great deal of controversy over his speech the night before, and people have really focused on, I think there's been some attention to what was taken out of his speech, and I can talk about that if listeners want. But I think what's even more remarkable is what he said, what he actually did say. He, echoing Randolph, said, "Let's not forget that we are in a massive social revolution." He called for people to be in the streets. He said, you know, one of the controversies was, he said, "We can't support the Civil Rights Act. It's just too little, too late." And that was one of the things that leaders of the march asked him to change. He said, "We support the Civil Rights Bill, but with great reservations." And then he went into this long list of things that it did not do. He said it doesn't address homelessness. It doesn't address the poverty of farm workers. He said, I think one of his most strongest statements was, "We need a law that will ensure the equality of a maid who earns $5 a week in the home of a family that earns $100,000 a year." Very powerful, I think, indictment of economic inequality.
And what did he cut out?
Well, there were a number of demands for things. The Archbishop of Washington actually demanded that he drop words like revolution and masses. The response of A. Philip Randolph was actually, "Well, I'm going to use those too, and so I don't have any problem with that." The other objections were that he didn't support the Civil Rights Act. And this was actually a really central part of the objectives of the march, was to pass this law. Every other speaker criticized the law a great deal, but they said, you need to actually say we want it. The other was that he vowed as he said, to march through the South like Sherman did, comparing the Civil Rights Movement to the Union general who burned big parts of the South during the Civil War. He said, "We need to burn Jim Crow to the ground." And then he added sort of ... nonviolently. And as you might expect, of the leaders, Martin Luther King, Bayard Rustin, who were really committed to nonviolent civil disobedience, they said, "We can't have a direct reference to violence in this speech."
And that would not play well with much of the South, I wouldn't think.
No. And it also, I think, sort of violated the spirit of, you know, of nonviolent civil disobedience.
You know, it occurs to me, and this is in the heart of the Cold War, and how much response to this kind of language in the March on Washington and elsewhere was to say, the civil rights movement is bleeding into socialism, is bleeding into communism here.
Yeah, well, this is a really important issue. Historians have debated this a lot, the effect that anti-communism and the sort of rhetoric of the Cold War and the climate had on the movement. And I actually find, surprisingly, that A. Philip Randolph and other leaders of the March on Washington managed to remain very, very radical in their politics and very committed to socialism without really coming under direct attack from more conservative anti-communists. Part of the reason for that was that A. Philip Randolph and many of the civil rights leaders were far more anti-communist than pretty much anybody around. A. Philip Randolph had really battled the Communist Party since the 1930s. And he felt that the Soviet Union and communism as it was implemented in the United States or in the Soviet Union really discredited the whole movement for socialism. So it was very hard for people to attack him as a communist.
So after the march, what changed? Did this change people's minds about civil rights and these labor issues and how they went together in the public at large?
Yeah, I think this is an important point because we often, I think, see this march as a turning point in public perception. And in fact, that's not so much the case. If you look at polling, in fact, support for racial equality does not take a marked move. that, in fact, many movements against civil rights laws emerge in the same period. So movements against equal open housing laws, similar, you know, and movements against open housing and opening up housing to African Americans actually took off in Chicago, in Milwaukee, actually. This is a turning point for those movements in California. And so in some ways, it kind of hardened popular positions. What it did shift was, I think, it put a coalition together that could pass legislation that would be remarkably effective. So most importantly, the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Well, I started by saying we're going to focus on things other than the I Have a Dream speech. But here it is, the end of the day. People are exhausted from their bus ride, from marching, from listening to speeches all day. Martin Luther King Jr. is up there. He delivers the I Have a Dream speech. Did he also focus on the issues you're trying to bring to light, the economic justice issues in this particular speech?
Well, he did to a certain extent. He talked about poverty. He used the sort of economic image of a check marked insufficient funds to sort of reference inequality and the persistence of inequality. One thing I think is important to remember is because he was the last speaker, his goal and his objective was not so much to lay out the specific demands of the march. That had been done over and over and over again by the time he got on stage. His goal was really to give an uplifting and rousing speech, and that's why they chose him. I mean, he was such a tremendous speaker, and the reason that we remember that speech is because it's such a powerful message, but not because it was sort of laying out the goals of the march.
Well, now let's fast forward to today, this week, and over the weekend, people commemorating the event, having interviews like this one. Do you think that the messages of jobs and freedom are up there alongside the I Have a Dream message as we look back on it?
I think those messages have largely fallen out of our popular memory of the event. I do think that those messages were very effective at the time. So there was a great deal of attention to the importance of both jobs and freedom. The Civil Rights Act itself, I mean, many people would consider Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which was the provision prohibiting employment discrimination, the most important element of that law. So they did have a great effect, but I think by now we've often forgotten that aspect of the march.
Why?
Well, part of it is the way in which we've remembered the march. The march itself was not remembered really prominently in the late 1960s and really came back to popularity through Martin Luther King's speech after Martin Luther King's death. So after his assassination in 1968, people really rediscovered the speech. It was a hopeful and optimistic speech in a time, the late 1960s, of increased frustration over the lack of progress over civil rights. And so people latched onto this speech, and it became a very well-known speech, in part because it's such an effective speech. I mean, it wasn't a mistake. But I think that's the way in which people sort of rediscovered the march. And when they did that, they rediscovered it through the speech that actually tells you the least, I think, about what the march was all about.
Will, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
That was William Jones, professor of history at UW-Madison. His new book, The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights.
Coming up, we'll hear the latest news and then take a look at the latest from Syria. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.